Welcome to Revitalize and Replant with Mark Clifton, where we equip pastors to take their churches from declining to thriving by pointing them to a new future and a new hope. Join us weekly for encouragement and practical advice in your pastoring journey. So it is the special edition of Revitalize and Replant with Mark Clifton. I'm Dan Hurst. And today we have a guest that we have talked about many, many times.
We have. We've talked about you a lot. You haven't been here.
But yes. But never had you on the show. We're dealing with somebody who, he's the book review editor for History and Historical Theology at Themelios, the academic journal for the Gospel Coalition. He's published numerous articles for websites, journals, magazines. Dr. Jeff Chang, who serves as the assistant professor of church history and historical theology and the curator of the Spurgeon Library.
All that applause is for you.
And now get this. He graduated from the University of Texas.
Uh-huh. That's true.
Did you have a football scholarship there?
I never played football.
Then he went to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary.
There he had a football scholarship.
There he had one. Then he went to Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, yeah, where he wrote his dissertation on Charles H. Spurgeon's ecclesiology. Mm-hmm. And that dissertation was so good,
yes,
that Midwestern hired him as this assistant professor of church history and historical theology and the curator of the Spurgeon Library, where he professed his love to his wife. Is her name Stephanie? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Boy, I professed my love for my wife before I got to Midwestern.
Oh, I thought it just happened as, you know.
But yes.
Anyway, Mark, say hello to Dr. Jeff Chang.
Hey, Dr. Chang. Thank you for being here. I've wanted to have
you
with us.
With you.
We both live in Kansas City. All three of us live in Kansas City.
Right.
But we decided to come all the way to Atlanta and do this podcast. So we're here at the North American Mission Board. We're
not in the Spurgeon Library.
We're not in the Spurgeon Library. That's right. We're in the Annie Armstrong Library. Actually, at Lottie Moon, we actually have a stand-up cardboard cutout of Lottie Moon out there. I'll go bring her in here in a minute, and we can do a really good podcast when she's watching us. So anyway, I have no idea what that means. Thank you for being here at the North American Mission Board as our guest. I have so wanted to have you on. Spurgeon has been such an influence in my life. Even this morning when I brought a struggle to bring a message to the brethren and sisters here in Alpharetta, I concluded the message with a quote from Spurgeon.
Such a good quote, by the way.
It is a great quote, isn't it? Are there any bad ones? Except the people that credit him with things he didn't say, probably. But no, I appreciate that. I just love him. He's just been such an influence in my ministry and my life. And, Dan and I went to William Jewell College back in the day in Missouri. And at that time, the Spurgeon Library was housed at William Jewell, although not many people knew about it. Mm-hmm. But what I want to talk about right now, I just want you to unpack for us Charles Spurgeon, just what he means, who he was, everything Spurgeon. I just want to drink it all in right now, Jeff. But before we do that, how did you first get introduced to him?
Yeah, so prior to coming to Midwestern, I was in pastoral ministry.
Uh-huh.
So I served in Portland, Oregon, at a church, Hinson Baptist Church, for about a decade there as the associate pastor. And as a pastor, you're always looking for good quotes.
Right.
You're looking for heroes in church history. So Spurgeon really was somebody that I began to read in my seminary days into my pastoral days. When I was doing my PhD studies at Midwestern, I emailed a kind of mentor friend of mine, Mark Dever.
Oh, yeah.
And I asked him, hey, what should I work on for my dissertation?
Yeah.
And right away, he said, look at Spurgeon's ecclesiology.
Okay.
Mark himself is a big fan of Spurgeon. He actually helped introduce me to Spurgeon because he, on Wednesday night, during the Wednesday night Bible studies, he would just read from the 4-volume autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And how much fun was that?
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, I began to really work in earnest on Spurgeon around 2016 as I began to do my doctoral studies there at Midwestern. And what a perfect place to study Spurgeon, with the Spurgeon Library right there.
Yes.
And as I looked at Spurgeon, I thought, his ecclesiology, and not just his ecclesiology, but his approach to pastoral ministry. What was Spurgeon like as a pastor?
Yeah.
That's what I was curious about. We hear so much about his huge preaching, his publishing, the controversies, all the charitable ministries that he was engaged in, the pastor's college. But I really just wanted to look at him as a pastor, because that's what I was at that time. What I came to find was that he was a Baptist pastor, there pastoring the largest evangelical church in the world, remaining committed to Baptist convictions about the church and about pastoral ministry. A little bit about Spurgeon.
Yes.
So he, born in 1834, died in 1892, kind of came to age at the height of kind of the British Empire. He grew up in the countryside. His grandfather was a minister. His father was a kind of bivocational minister. Got saved as a teenager around the age of 15. And right away, after his conversion, he was on fire. He was
to preaching. Well, we're going to do two podcasts. So you guys who are listening, we're going to do this one on the background of Spurgeon. Then we're going to do another one on Spurgeon as a pastor and as a revitalizing pastor. Right? So let's back up for a minute. All right.
Okay.
So did he or did he not go into a bar when he was 6 years old and tell a guy that he was disappointing his grandfather, who is the pastor, and he needs to come out of that bar and quit drinking? Is that true?
Yeah, well, it's recorded in his autobiography. That's right. I think that was you see his passion for church discipline at a young age, you know. And supposedly this man reformed his life
after
he was confronted by 6 year old Spurgeon.
See, there you go.
There you go.
Yeah, there are a lot of things attributed to Spurgeon that aren't Spurgeon.
I'm
just going to call him out right now. Tony Mattia in Wamego, Kansas. He calls himself the Spurgeon of the Plains,
by the way.
And, he was into Spurgeon before anybody else was. I mean, he's just loved him his whole life. And so he got this brand new church sign. It's huge. Like it was the biggest church sign in the county. So he's real proud of it. And it had the changeable marquee. So I'm driving up there. It's in Wamego, Kansas. And I'm driving up there one day. And the church sign says, the truth is putting on its boots as a lie travels around the world. Charles Spurgeon. So I pulled in the parking lot. I said, Mattia, that's Mark Twain. Everybody knows. Google it. It's Mark Twain. No, that's Charles Spurgeon. I said, no, it's Mark Twain. So he goes, well, I'm going to leave it up as Spurgeon anyway. So a lot of things people say Spurgeon
hilarious.
Said, he didn't say. And a lot of stories about him are probably apocryphal or whatever. But the one about him being 6 years old and going in and pulling a guy out of a bar. How was he converted?
So he felt the conviction of sin from an early age. He grew up in a Christian home. He grew up going to church, hearing a lot of preaching about the Bible. He would have said that he didn't hear the gospel very clearly. In a lot of those early years. He heard a lot of preaching about what a Christian should do, but not how you become a Christian. He read a lot of Puritan theology, which, gave him a good, solid theological foundation, but it also turned him more into introspection, thinking about his sin, considering the weight of his sin. So, as a young teenager, he was plagued by these doubts, these questions, didn't really know the way of salvation. One winter, he was back in his hometown of Colchester. There was a plague in Newmarket where he went to school, so he had to go back home. And he decided that winter to visit every chapel in town.
Oh, is that right?
And perhaps somebody will tell him the way of salvation.
Okay.
And so one Sunday morning, January 6, 1850, he's walking to another chapel, but then this strange snowstorm kind of blows in. He's forced to take shelter down an alleyway. He finds a primitive Methodist church. There on Artillery Street. And he shows up there kind of soaking wet, and the regular preacher couldn't make it. And so some unknown deacon takes the pulpit and preaches a very simple message from the book of Isaiah. Look unto me and be saved, all ye ends of the earth. And as Spurgeon sat there listening to this preacher, the preacher even calls him out, young man, you look miserable, and you will continue to be miserable until you look to Christ. And yet for Spurgeon, something about what he was saying finally made sense. He had been waiting so long to do something for Christ, but now he was being called simply to look to Christ.
Yeah.
And then he said at that moment, the clouds parted, the sun broke through, and he was converted. I love that story because, there have been so many Sunday mornings after a snowstorm.
Mm-hmm.
You show up at church, nobody's there, right?
I
mean, just a handful of people.
Right.
But you preach the gospel.
Right.
You never know what God may do in a moment like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So is this a deacon at a primitive Methodist church?
That's right.
I'm going to go out on a liner because, I don't know exactly the answer to this. I'm thinking primitive Methodists were actually Calvinistic, weren't they?
No, they were not.
They weren't. Weren't there some Methodists that were Calvinistic initially, early on?
Well, they tend to be. Those were the Calvinistic Methodists, mostly in Wales, but some smaller parts of
I knew there were some Calvinistic Methodists.
No, they tended to be Arminian. Spurgeon would go back the following Sunday and thinking like, okay, I got saved here.
Right.
This is where I should go to church.
Right.
And the preacher would preach on Romans 7 and basically say, no, Paul here is not talking about the Christian experience. We understand that he began to teach a kind of perfectionism,
okay,
a Wesleyan perfectionism.
Okay.
And so Spurgeon right away knew, okay, this is not the church for me.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate that. But I knew there was some Calvinistic Methodist somewhere.
Yes.
I read about those, I didn't know. Okay. Well, excellent. Oh, are you all with us still? Dan, are you awake?
this is like a conversation thing.
It is.
Two Spurgeon fans kind of geeking out on
Spurgeon.
It's
getting a little deep here.
That's fine. I like that.
But I do too. And by the way, I do carry with me in my Bible. I didn't use it today, but I often carry with me a blue polka dot handkerchief. I do.
Yeah, I know that reference.
and there are times that I have, I don't really wave it around like Spurgeon did, but it just reminds me that he would wave that blue polka dot handkerchief and that kind of thing.
That.
So anyway, he did that. Okay, so talk to me now. That was his conversion. And then his first church was where? How did he get to his first church?
Yeah, so after his conversion, like I said, he's baptized upon his profession of faith as a believer. And right away, he begins to just get as busy as he can in his local church, right? There in Newmarket, later that summer of 1850, he moves to Cambridge, joins St. Andrew's Baptist Church. He's teaching Sunday school. And one of the men there noticed this young, zealous Christian, and he recruits him to join his lay preaching society.
Ah, cool.
So there, as a 16-year-old, he begins to preach, which is very unusual in the 19th century, 16-year-old preacher.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, he's a good preacher. He's something of a phenom. And he's going around the villages surrounding Cambridge, leading services, preaching sermons. In fact, one of the projects that we've done at the Spurgeon Library is this thing called the Lost Sermons of C.H. Spurgeon.
Okay.
And that's what these are. We, for the very first time, published the sermon notes that he was using as he was preaching as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 18-, 19-year-old.
Really? Yeah. How many volumes is that?
So we have 7 volumes total.
Really?
But they come from 9 notebooks of sermons. So close to 400 sermons.
How did you acquire those notebooks?
Those notebooks were sitting in the archives at the Spurgeon's College, UK. And they were found by our previous curator, Christian George.
Uh-huh.
And then so he set about the work of printing them. When Spurgeon first got to London at New Park Street, he intended to publish these notebooks, but he just got too busy.
So we'll put a link in the show notes, and you can buy those now, right?
You can, yeah. The whole thing is finished.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
What a
so thing. So he's preaching, and eventually he ends up preaching in this little village called Water Beach, and they're so taken with this 17-year-old that they call him to be their pastor.
Is that right?
From 17 to 19, he is a bivocational pastor. He's tutoring in the mornings there in Cambridge, and in the evenings and on weekends, he's pastoring this church in Water Beach.
And baptized in the River Lark, right?
At the age of 15, after he's converted, he was baptized.
I just say that Tony Mattia, my friend, who—
He has water from the River Lark?
And he gave me a bottle of it. So I have a bottle of water from the River Lark, and I may or may not put a drop of that in the baptistry.
No, come on.
When I baptize. No, I do. I have a bottle of water from the River Lark.
That's like, well, we have a large bottle of it at the Spurgeon Library, and it is accumulating some growth.
Mine is too.
A little strange.
Mine looks pretty odd in there. And you also, the Spurgeon Library, we'll talk about the library in a minute, but you mentioned his conversion. And you have a bench from that church?
We've got pews from that Artillery Street Primitive Methodist Church.
How did you get those pews? Did they know you took them or what?
They were very kind.
Late at night with a truck, huh? No, tell me about that.
The church is still ongoing. It's an evangelical church these days.
Really?
And their pews are now up in the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we visited, we got to explore a little bit. And we were like, hey, these are the original pews.
Yeah.
Can we take one? And they were very kind.
So at the Spurgeon Library, you have one of the pews that was there when he was
converted.
It could
be very well the pew that he was sitting on, like to say.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. All right, so Park Street, right? He went to Park Street.
So Water Beach, then eventually word gets out of this phenomenal country preacher, so much so that New Park Street in London, a historic Baptist church, they invite him to come and do pulpit supply. He shows up December 1853, preaches there for the very first time. And right away, people are struck. Like, this is not preaching we've heard before. You know, it's doctrinal and yet very warm and full of the gospel, full of affection for Christ. And they quickly invite him back. And by the next spring, they've called him to be their pastor.
Where do you think that preaching came from? I mean, was he shaped by somebody else, or is this completely new? I mean, as you think about the Puritans he was reading, the other preachers of the day, I mean, he was truly unique, correct?
Yeah, that's right. You see the influence on his preaching in the Lost Sermons. So, you know, he shows up in London. He's 19 years old. By that first Sunday that he's preached in London, he has preached 689 sermons.
Really?
So I mean, just think about it. If a pastor preaches 50 sermons a year,
right,
689, that's like 13 years of preaching experience as a 19-year-old. So he, and in those sermons, I mean, his doctrine is shaped by men like John Gill, John Owen, Calvin. His preaching style, I think, has been shaped by William Jay, Charles Simeon,
right?
You know, some significant preachers of his day and of the previous generation. So, I mean, all that has been, and he's just been learning to preach by actually doing it.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, now, he shows up as an experienced preacher.
When did he start to publish his sermons?
By 1854, he's been called as a pastor in the spring. And by the fall, I mean, the church is starting to fill out. People are coming from all over London to hear him. Enough that the Baptist magazines are wanting him to publish his sermons. So, yeah, he's starting to publish his sermons in the Baptist magazines by the fall of 54. And then by January 55, he's beginning to publish his own sermons with Passmore and Alabaster.
I gotcha. Yeah. So you showed me one day when I was at the library, you showed me some of his notes. He would go into the pulpit with not a manuscript.
That's right.
What would he go in the pulpit with?
Yeah, so you have about a half sheet of paper, a somewhat detailed outline, but it's still just an outline. And yet, behind each sentence, each line in that outline, I mean, there will be mountains of thought that you bring into the sermons.
I know. Just today, as I said, I quoted Spurgeon at the conclusion of a message that I preached this morning here in Alpharetta, just two or three paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
Every word was important. Mm-hmm. Every sentence carried huge weight.
Yeah.
And to think you could just do that without having that written out, just extemporaneously.
Yeah.
Just beautiful poetry.
That's right.
Amazing, powerful gospel communication,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and a great use of the language.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
tremendous.
Yeah,
and so he went to the pulpit not, you know, people think because his sermons are written out that he went to the pulpit with them all completely written out.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they get written if he didn't write them out when he preached?
Yeah, so he would have men in the congregation, stenographers, who would take down his sermons, you know, longhand as he's preaching. And he would receive these 50-page manuscripts, you know, during the week, and he would edit them and then send them to press.
Okay. Well, that makes – that's a little simple. You know, I for my 50th birthday, my wife gave me some of his notes.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
obviously, you can see it's in a different color ink.
That's right.
And he edits it and sits his handwriting and that
mm-hmm,
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you okay over there, Hurst?
Well, you know,
Hurst,
I'm dying here.
You're dying. You're coughing.
Yeah.
It's fun to watch you try not to cough. We can't afford a cough button on our podcast.
No.
It costs more, so we go without them. So, I'm sorry, but
we're raw.
Are you doing well?
I am. I'm doing
all right. Well, Spurgeon was often ill, right?
He was.
So, talk to me about that. What he struggled with?
Yeah, you know, he was not an athletic man. He had a larger build.
I can't imagine. Can you, Hurst?
I identify with him. Are you talking?
So, you know. He struggled with all kinds of various ailments, you know, kidney issues. He dealt with gout, you know, later on in life. He was also just under a tremendous amount of stress, you know, and pressure. And so he was often discouraged under the weight of ministry. You know, these days people might, even like, as they read his writings, they might wonder if he was like clinically depressed.
Right.
You know. Yeah, so there was one episode particularly, 1856, the Surrey Gardens Music Hall disaster.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, terrible. Sunny evening, wasn't it?
Yeah. So where he was preaching before a crowd of 10,000 and some troublemakers yelled fire, causing a stampede. 7 people died.
Yeah.
And the trauma kind of having led through that stayed with him for the rest of his life.
Right.
There would be times where the memories of that would come back. So. Both sort of emotionally and physically, Spurgeon struggled.
And I think oftentimes those two things are connected.
Yes.
And a lot of guys who are listening to us struggle with both of those things.
Yeah, emotionally, physically, and then connected with that spiritually. He,
right.
in the midst of that discouragement, God would feel distant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he talks about that. And yet it's in those moments where he would preach to himself, where he would remind himself of his hope in Christ. I think it's because of those experiences that Spurgeon came to be one of the reasons why he came to be such a good preacher, because he could preach to those who were hurting.
Mm-hmm.
When they would hear him talk, they would hear one who has been through what they've been through.
I think that is a lot of what I find attractive in him. I've struggled with depression most of my life, and so I find that very much attractive in him. I know when I was at the library one day, Richard Blackaby was with me on a Sunday morning, and you were so gracious to open up the library. Not that you do that for everybody. Don't be thinking that. But you were so gracious to show up early that morning and open the library so Richard and I could look at it. And you pulled out some unpublished letters that he'd written, sort of partial letters. Right. They weren't even complete. And he was writing a letter on a train. And I read it in his own handwriting that he was so discouraged and so despondent, he didn't know if he was able to continue. And you don't know who he was writing to. It was just a portion of a letter.
Right.
But here you have Spurgeon, at the height of his ministry, basically saying all these things were coming upon him so much. And I think, look, discouragement and depression, I know Andy Davis says, is Satan's best tool. And he uses it against many times his best leaders. And I think Spurgeon lived with that. But I think you're right. He leaned into it to become closer to Christ, and it was evident in his preaching. Also, if you're going to live like that and you're going to preach that way, there's going to be a price to pay in terms of spiritual warfare.
Yeah, that's right.
So he left Park Street, and why did he leave Park Street, and then how did he get to the Tabernacle?
Well, he didn't leave New Park Street. So the church grew so much that they needed a new building. So he undertook kind of one of the most ambitious building projects in the evangelical world of his day. They built this magnificent new building called the Metropolitan Tabernacle, seated 6,000 people. I mean, the challenge there is what kind of preacher can hold a steady congregation of 6,000 people?
And right? So the New Park Street became the Metropolitan Tabernacle.
That's right. That's right.
They just changed the name or changed the whole church?
They changed the location, changed the
name. Basically,
but it was the same congregation.
Yeah, but really a new church, new name, new location.
Yeah.
But the same initial congregation.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Yeah. And so what year was that?
1861.
Mm-hmm. Seated 6,000 people.
Seated 6,000. And from there, I mean, the first 7 years there at New Park Street, those were these amazing kind of revival years where they had outgrown their building. So Spurgeon was preaching a lot at different locations, Exeter Hall in London, the music hall, large congregations. Once he gets to Metropolitan Tabernacle in 61, the ministry really kind of has a new base of operations, and from there, the pastor's college grows, the orphanages come out of that, all of the charitable institutions, the preaching
ministry. So how many years did he live after they moved to the Tabernacle?
Yeah, so he dies in 1892. So 30-ish more years.
30-ish years, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's part one. So you got to wait for part two, and we're going to talk about Spurgeon as a church revitalizer, replanter, because in a sense he didn't replant the church, but he moved it, changed its name, and brought it back. And we'll talk a little bit about the history of even New Park Street. So we'll do that when we come back next week. All right, Dan?
All right.
Or
so,
2 weeks from now, or whenever we come back. I don't know.
Whenever they'll let us come back.
Whenever they'll let us come back. All right.
That's the you've been listening to Revitalize and Replant with Mark Clifton. We've been talking to Dr. Jeff Chang, who is with the Spurgeon Library, curator of the Spurgeon Library at Midwestern Seminary. And we'll continue with him. Fascinating discussion, and one that I think most of us can at some point identify with. I hope you'll plan on listening to that again. Please feel free to send us a note and let us know what you think. And if this has been a blessing to you, we want to know about that. If it hasn't, I guess we want to know about it.
Nah, but keep it to yourself.
but thank you to the North American Mission Board. They've made their podcast studio available to us, and we're grateful for their support for that. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for joining us today on Revitalize and Replant. This podcast is brought to you by the North American Mission Board, where we help dying or struggling churches regain health for the glory of God and the good of their communities. If you found this conversation helpful, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platform. To learn more about becoming a replanting pastor or to explore resources about revitalization for your own church, visit churchreplanters.com.